Okay. So I am thankful for the question that I have here. Generally, by the way, again, I just heard that in the past there has been such a thing here. People just dropped off questions through all the week. So if anyone wants to do anything like that, ask any questions on any subject, either at the time, earlier, during the week, during the night, verbally, in writing, whatever it is, all good. Before I address this question, I want to go back a drop to what we discussed a little bit last week. So that
we... Sure.
Okay, so that's good. Now I want to go back to what we discussed a little bit last week before I move on further with the Chayvus Halvavus and with the question here which refers to that. We discussed last week how the Siddur are words of Chazal. Chazal chose these words in the Siddur for the purpose of giving us what to daven. But I want to make this point over here, which I think is important in general about what tefillah is. The word tefillah itself. What is that word? Where does it come from? I remember teaching in a seminary years ago, and I asked this question. I asked, what is the word tefillah? And somebody immediately said that it comes from naftule elikim niftalti. That's not the pashtus. If you pay attention to the word naftule elikim, you see it's peitof lamed, in that order, a psil is something that is twisted together, wound together, connected, right? It's a very beautiful idea, but it's peitof lamed. Tefillah, if anything, is pei lamed, and even if there's a tof in there, the tof there goes before the pei, not after the pei. So again, like I said, it's a nice idea, but it's not the plain pshat. So what is the plain pshat? What is it all about with tefillah? I want to say an idea that most people have not heard before, which is that we find the idea in Parshas Vayechi, which we just recently had 2 weeks ago, where actually it's in Parshas Vayigash, where Yaakov says to Yosef, he says, it's in Vayechi, Ra'ifonecha lo'ifi lolti, I did not think that I would see your face. And I'm lucky enough that Hashem showed me not only your face, but your children's face as well. So the word pei lamed lamed there, lefalel, means to think. We find other places like this, in Parshas Mishpatim we have nosam befalilim, you should pay according to the decision of the judges. It's the same idea, lefalel means to think. The thinkers. The judges are the thinkers. They think it through. They figure it out. And therefore, based on what they figure out and think, they give a psak. So lefalel means to think. So if we use lefalel as the root word of thinking, what would it mean? Lahis palel, which is the form of speech, which is to cause something to oneself. Right? That's the form of speech of causing something to oneself when you start off with a hay soft before it, and his palo means to make yourself think. In other words, one of the major purposes and points of davening is actually to make yourself think. To make yourself think goes along the lines of what we discussed last week, where, you know, if you're making yourself think because, like we said, to learn Torah is you speaking about what Hashem is saying to you. But when you daven and you're saying what you're saying to him, so as it comes out of your mouth, you're making yourself think the same thing. Like we spoke last week, Tvorim HaYoytzim Min Halei, when something comes out of your heart, it goes into your heart also. So when it comes out of your mouth, you want it to come back in. You want to create a thought process in yourself. Once we understand that tefillah is about how you think, Now, when Chazal give you the words in the Siddur, it's not just a matter of, like I said last week, well, how can we rely on ourselves to be ready to speak, or to be ready to daven, to be ready to feel, to be ready to express? So instead, we'll give you something else to keep you busy, sort of. It's much more than that. The words, the ideas, the concepts that are in the Siddur were put there specifically and specially to give us, if we're going to make ourselves think, what do we want to make ourselves think? What do we want to be thinking about? What are the ideas we want to put into our minds? This is really the question. And here the words were chosen with the greatest and most tremendous ideas and principles of emuna, of bitachon, of connection to Hashem, of relationship with Hashem, were put into that siddur in order to give us the opportunity to put that into our own minds. So those are the words that were chosen specifically and expressly for that purpose, to get the ideas. If we understand that, we understand that actually the Siddur is one of the greatest textbooks of learning about Hashem, of learning about Emunah, learning about Bitachon, learning about a relationship with Hashem, learning about what we can understand about Hashem, learning about what we want to believe about Hashem, learning about who Hashem is, should all be in that Siddur. And especially for most of us, who don't necessarily have the easiest time to take these words and really get an understanding of them, Pirush HaMilos is often a tremendous challenge, right? Especially for those of us to whom Hebrew is not our first language, and even to those of us who Hebrew is our first language, because even if Hebrew is our first language, it doesn't mean that the words of the Siddur are exactly the form of Hebrew that we have, or that we easily will delve into the depth of the words that are there. And therefore, if we ever want to have a class where we study the Siddur, we should have the appreciation and the understanding that what's in there is tremendous messages to us about what we can put into our own minds. And I hope that Hashem, as we go along, I want to discuss a little further how important that is, what we actually put into our minds.
Is it true that even if one doesn't understand the word,
Absolutely.
Even if you don't understand.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is it better to say to people even if you cannot read it
so well? That's the question.
English?
That's the question. That's where that concept comes from. I believe it was Chafetz Chaim who was asked this question. Should one use the words in Lashon Kodesh even if they don't understand them, if they could use English, let's say, or whatever language was being asked about then, which they understand better? And he said what you just said, which is the words have a power of their own. As they should, by the way. Again, they're words of Torah, either straight out of Tanakh or words of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah who immediately followed the Tanakh. These are the greatest human beings who ever walked the face of this earth. They understood the depths and the secrets of this world in ways that none of us ever will. And therefore, those words have a power of their own, absolutely. Today, Baruch Hashem, we don't have to have an either-or type of choice, because with Siddurim like Art Scroll and others like that,
you can... Even if you read all those things in English, it doesn't... It's not...
I don't think I can understand it, but it's not as simple as all that, you know, when you're reading it carefully and really understanding what you're really reading. Yeah, I mean, you can read the English, but there's more to it than just that English. Okay, so what we'll try to do over here is to try to get the understanding before we even get into the Siddur, so that we can jump into the Siddur with the understanding at the time we get to the davening. We not only will understand hopefully the translation, but rather also what else is in there besides the just plain literal translation? What else is going on inside those words? What can we get out of there, right? Okay. So now, let's get to back to the Chaimus HaLvavos, which we began to discuss. So the first thing, the first concept, we saw that there are five concepts in the Chaimus HaLvavos. Whoever has their copy, and there were some also put away over here somewhere. Yeah, the Pope is around somewhere. Let's ask her, she's upstairs. Should be a bunch of copies somewhere. Okay, I'll read it hopefully loudly and clearly, so even those who are not looking at it inside should be able to follow. And he says, the purpose of tefillah, and the first purpose was, His yachadus hanefesh Lefnei Hashem Yishadar V'Yisrael. Right? Which means we're talking about unification with Hashem. Unification with Hashem. Communion with Hashem over here. What does that mean? This is the tremendous desire, yearning of the human soul, the yearning of the human soul to unify with the soul of this world, which is Hashem Himself. And this is true to the largest degree that it is possible in this world at all. Right? However much it's possible to commune with, unify with Hashem in this world, happens in davening, and this is where this question came, which is, how does one achieve dveikus to Hashem through tefillah? In other words, we spoke about it in general terms last week as a concept, as an idea, but what if somebody doesn't find that so simple? In other words, I assumed last week, and I may have been right or wrong for the majority of people, but at least for some people I was definitely wrong. What I said last week was, everyone knows what that means, right? In other words, everyone has had an experience like that in their life, even if it happens once every year or two, where you actually feel a tremendous connection to Hashem. Feel a yearning towards Him, a yearning to connect, which itself is a form of connection. It's a tremendous form of connection. To feel that yearning is a form of connection, right? But the question over here is, how is that done? Or as it was expressed differently, what if I never had anything like that in my life? What if I've never felt that way? Ever? What if that has never happened? What is that? I mean, why are you assuming that this is something that actually happened to me? Maybe never happened to me. Now, I think, first of all, just to respond directly to the question before answering it, I think the question itself and the coming out with its own yearning is some expression of yearning of its own. No question about it. In other words, to not care is more of a disconnection. To care and to say, how do I get to there? It's coming from a place of its own, especially when it comes from a tremendous feeling of its own, as it sometimes does. But I want to answer this on two levels. One on a religious level, and one on a more emotional level. Let's start with the religious level, which is more common. How is it that a person prepares themselves for the davening to be more meaningful than it is? Of course, besides understanding what the words are, it's very difficult to say words that you don't begin to understand and to have those inspire you to feel like you're connecting to anyone, right? But beyond that, even if one were using their own words, maybe sometimes that's also an issue. In other words, maybe it's not an issue of understanding the words, which obviously is a block of its own. What if it's beyond that? What if I'm using my own words and I don't feel like I have any connection? In other words, the real question on a religious level is, how much of a real, tangible relationship do I walk around feeling at all times? Not only in times of, let's say, need, where I feel desperate, and when I'll reach out and call out to Hashem because I feel like I'm lost otherwise, I can't do this on my own, and I need to throw myself on somebody, I need someone to cry to, so maybe now I'll be able to connect to Hashem, maybe that's a step that I can do. But what about just in general? Do I feel like I have a relationship with anybody? Is there a relationship going on here on a steady basis? And here we have the suggestion, that's not my suggestion, it's a suggestion of the Rishonim, comes from the Rambam, it comes from the Chavis Lubavitch himself, where they speak about seeing Hashem everywhere. Now this is something that most of us are used to understanding on the level of personal Hashgacha, which means I see Hashem when something nice happens to me. I see Hashem, in other words, for better or for worse, when I need to come across Him. Either I need to come across Him because I'm stuck, or I come across Him because I found $100 in the street. Right? But how about seeing Hashem literally on all sides? Because the truth of the matter is, He's there. Everywhere. I'm not talking about now the song of Hashem is there, Hashem is there. I'm talking about He's there on all sides in a literal, tangible sense. In the most literal and tangible sense, in nature, Hashem is everywhere. In other words, when you walk down the street, or you sit down at your table, or you're in your kitchen, or you look up to the sky, and I don't want this to be just words, because everybody's heard it, it's just words too many times. Real thing now. To be able to open your eyes, look around, and see Hashem on all sides, because it is Him. It is Him, right? And whether we see Him at such or not, it's Him. He's right there. He is there. Everything exists and it is Hashem. But like the Rambam says, look up at the skies. What's going on out there? Look at a blade of grass. What's going on over there? Look at an animal, a tiny animal. Does anyone ever think about the crazy things that I think about sometimes? You see a little ant walking in the street and you think, is there a brain and a heart inside that tiny body like that? What's going on there that's making this thing live and move, right? Something is motivating this little thing over there, and it's actually able to move. You ever think about that? It means something, right? It doesn't have to be as tiny as that. A bird is also pretty amazing. It doesn't have to be as tiny as that either. Big things are also pretty amazing. But you start to think, and you see animate objects or inanimate objects, and you look around and start seeing the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. This doesn't have to be once a year on your nature trip. This is every time you walk down the street. It's there. It's inescapable, actually. Was it, I think it was the Chazon Ish who said this, I believe it was the Chazon Ish who said, that he can literally pass out from studying a flower. He can literally pass out from it, he says, literally. And he wasn't lying, he can literally pass out. Rav Avigdor Miller, Zichrono Livracha, I don't know who knew him personally, but he wasn't a person who generally was given to allowing his emotions to get in control of much. He used to daven without moving. It's very rare, my men, for that to happen. In other words, normally in the shul, everybody's chuckling. Rabbi Miller used to stand straight like a rod. But I heard him say that at one point in his life, he was up in the mountains, I believe, and he went behind the bungalow, and he got down on the ground, and he studied nature in his immediate radius of the couple of feet that he was at. He was looking at ants, he was looking at the grass. He said something that most people would see as an exaggeration, but he said it's the closest to Nevuah that I believe that I could have ever gotten. It was several hours there worth of him, you know, getting into whatever was going on there. Now, in a way, I wanted to use these extreme stories because sometimes if you don't use extreme stories, you don't get what the point is. But on the other hand, I'd hate to use extreme stories because then we start to think, well, if I don't have the time to do these crazy stuff, so I can't have anything to do with this. That's not true. It's the little things that constantly count. What does it mean when you take a piece of food into your mouth and it tastes good? I'm not talking about big tzidkoniyos, chas v'shalom, we don't have any tam and achila. But the rest of us who actually like food, right, and who enjoy it, right? What is it that stops us from falling in love with the Rebbeinu Shel Olam right then and there? These are words, what should I do? I'm a Talmud of Rabbi Avigdor Miller, and this is the way he used to talk all the time. But he used words like falling in love with the Rebbeinu Shel Olam over a piece of watermelon. These were words that he used, right? I don't want it to sound crazy, because it's not. It's not crazy. And it doesn't have to be some kind of extreme situation. It could really be a situation where, to the degree that it's possible, and again, everybody, I understand, all of us are busy all the time. We don't have a lot of time to be meditating. But it doesn't take a lot of meditation. It takes 30 seconds, these kind of situations, to really think. One story which I suspect I may share here in the future, probably more than once again. Again, going back to Rabbi Miller, is that one of his grandchildren was in the house when he was, did I say it already last week? I don't think I can tell, say every week. Yeah? So he's sitting, yeah, but it wasn't the only time? Yeah? Okay. I say it more often than not. And he was, his grandson was in the house, and suddenly he hears his footsteps coming up the stairs, so they know lived above the shul. He's coming up the stairs, and so it sounds like some Hasidic Shemaisi, he hides behind the door to watch what's going on. I suspect that he's hid behind the door because he didn't belong in the house at that time. And he didn't expect his grandfather to show up, so he didn't know where to go. But either way, he found himself behind the door. And Rabbi Miller comes in and sits down at the table, to his great mazel. He's behind the door at the dining room, and that's exactly the room that his grandfather chooses to sit down in. And on the table is a bowl of apples, and probably of other fruits. And Rabbi Miller chooses a red delicious apple. This is his favorite. He used to talk about it all the time. Puts it down on the table right in front of him. And he starts talking out loud in Yiddish. He's having a dialogue with Hashem. His first language was Yiddish, by the way. It's hard to believe when anyone has ever heard his tapes. And you hear the kind of English that he used. And you try to imagine that he actually never used English outside of those outside of those lectures, he never spoke English. He only spoke Yiddish his entire life, except these lectures in the shul. So he starts speaking out loud in Yiddish, and his Yiddish was just as good as his English, by the way. Words, rare words in Yiddish that even the fluent Yiddish speakers have never heard of before. And he starts speaking to Rabbi Yisrael. He says, bring the Dalma Kulik, take a look at this apple. I can believe it. Take a look how gorgeous it is. The color, the red color is amazing, but the red color wasn't here the whole time. Because as long as you weren't looking to attract me to eat this piece of fruit, it was green and it was hiding between the leaves. It was inconspicuous. It was unattractive and inconspicuous. And then finally, when you wanted, you put this color here just to attract my eye and to make it more appetizing for me. But you didn't make me climb up the tree to take it down, because when it became ripe, it fell off the tree. But it didn't just fall off the tree because it became soft. The stem of the apple. You ever see the apples as they come in the store with the stem on them still? So it's not that the apple changed when it became ripe and it released the stem. It doesn't release the stem. The stem releases the branch. Can you imagine this mechanism that's put in there so that the stem develops this abscess where it connects to the branch and it leaves go and it comes down? Why is that? Why does it have to fall down? And I really used to say that Sir Isaac Newton, they say that the way that he stumbled upon gravity was that he was sitting under an apple tree and then the apple fell down and hit him on the head. So he said, why did the apple fall down? Why didn't it fall up? Oh, so I had to think, and he thought about gravity. He said, but he was missing the first question. He skipped the question. Why did it fall at all? Forget about up or down. Why did it fall off the tree? And here he's talking to the Rebbe Shlom. This monologue is going on. And he says, and it smells so good. And look at the shape. And look at this. And look at that. And the taste is the exact combination of sugars and acids as to make it exactly fit. And when he's like, all prunos, after 5 minutes of this, he takes a knife and he says, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Barei Pri Atzim. He cuts off a piece and eats it. And as he swallows the first bite, he says, ah, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, punkt azoi v'mom geret azoi yedos. Exactly as we just schmooze, that's exactly the way it is. So this seed over here, when was he closer to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam? Before that apple or after? So what, was he in denial of the delicious quality of a piece of fruit? No, he wasn't in denial of it at all. The contrary, he was living this. When you're living with the Rebbeinu Shel Olam to such a degree, not to mention if once a week for 30 seconds while you're driving or walking, mostly driving, in the street, and you stop at a red light and you have 30 seconds right there, and you're thinking that you have the Rebbeinu Shel Olam right here next to you, and it's a little awkward for about 30 seconds, and then you forget about it because you just drove further. Okay, you're a different person than you were before, and you're much different than most people out there. If this is going on, and there is a running relationship going on all the time where you see the Rebbeinu Shel Olam in your life again, not only in his actions in your life, but in everything you come across, you know how uncomfortable it is? I'll speak for myself right now. But I suspect that I may not be the only one. Could be I am. But Rabbi Miller, when he was under the train tracks, they have the train tracks in New York, there are train tracks on the top of the elevated trains, and when the train goes by, you literally cannot hear yourself think. Forget about anyone else near you hearing you. You cannot hear yourself. The noise is deafening. And Rabbi Miller used to use that moment to scream on top of his lungs in the middle of the street, if this happened to him, I love you, Hashem! He used to scream this way because he, when else can you do it? Even inside your house, your neighbors will hear. They're going to come running soon here too. But he did that. Now, how comfortable does everyone feel to actually do that? Or even to say those words out of your mouth in English and feel like you're actually talking to somebody? It feels awkward sometimes, right? It can feel awkward to do that. It can feel artificial, it can feel hypocritical. But that means that there's a barrier there that needs to be crossed, right? If you don't feel comfortable to say that, and he used to say, I said, you never in your life said those words, I'm afraid you're going to have to come back. Right? To say that in English, he said, say it in your own language. So this is something that's not going on during davening. This is going on before and outside of davening. And when a person has this type of running conversation going on, the davening is a different davening. It's a whole different story altogether. And to this I want to throw in also Reb Chatzkel Levenstein, which is somebody asked him, he said, okay, what should I do? He says, I start Shemoneh Esrei and I say Hakel Hagodol. Hagodol, by the way, means, maybe eventually, hopefully, we'll get to Shemoneh Esrei, but Hagodol means the kindly one. That's a literal and simple translation. The great means the kindly one. Many, many different proofs of that. So he says, okay, so I say Hagodol. Now I start thinking, Hagodol, yeah, it's full of chesed taka. That's taka true. That's taka true. There's so much chesed in the world. The world is full of so much kindness. Let me think about that for a minute. Well, and then, okay, half hour later, we start Hagibur. Hagibur, oh, mighty, 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 yeah. Hashem does have a lot of might, doesn't he? What's the might of Hashem? And then a half hour later, we move on to Hanoyer. By this time, everyone has been at work for an hour and a half, and meanwhile, you're still davening. So how does this work? Your apostle was asked. So he said, no, that's not the way to do it, he said. He said, Hagodol is what you should be thinking about all day, not when you start Shemoneh Esrei. Hagibur you should be thinking about all day, not in the Shemoneh Esrei. Hanoyer, all night. And when you get to Shemoneh Esrei, and you've been thinking about this before, you know what these things mean to you, they already say something to you. So when you say that word, it turns into a headache. Hagodol. Hagibur, that's right. Hanoyer, that's right. That's right. What? Everything I always think about. I don't have to start from scratch now as I say those words. So again, if I have made a spiritual and religious preparation before, my davening has a chance of having much more meaning. And again, that combines, of course, with the other preparation of understanding actually what the words mean. But again, what I'm talking about more is experiencing Hashem within nature, within the world, seeing, getting excited at least occasionally by such things, and not being embarrassed to be excited. You see the rain come down, you're allowed to be excited about that. Even if you live in Detroit and you see it every other day. It's fine. There's still something exciting about rain. What is it? It's Hashem sending water down. That's what it is. He's sending water down from the sky to us. So it bothers you? Don't use it. You need it, no? Need what? Every single thing on this earth only survives because of water. Every single thing on this earth. Every piece of food you take into your mouth is water. Every single drop of any drink you take into your mouth is water. And 60 to 70% of your body is water. Right? You are a piece of water. That's what you are. So you're not even complaining. Nasty rain. Okay. You know, you would think there would be a limit to ingratitude. You know, we're all human beings. I understand that part. But the truth of the matter is, you know, one of my kids said, it doesn't have to rain. We'll get water from the sink. Right? Because it only gets to the sink because it rains. So these things are going on all the time. There's an excitement to all these things. If we don't let things get in the way of that, we will be relating to the Rebbe Hashem all the time. And therefore, when we get to a situation where we say, I want to commune with Hashem, there is a Hashem to commune with. Otherwise, even if you are the frumste tzaddikus in the entire world, Hashem could still be, to a certain degree and in a certain sense, a word in the Siddur. But not something that is living and breathing out there, not breathing. But Keil Chai, Hashem is alive. He's alive. He's alive. He's alive in the most major sense possible. He's the one who's most alive. The rest of us are alive because He wants us to be alive right now, so we are. He's the only one who is really alive, and He is. So He's alive in the sense of He's active. He's making decisions and taking action on all sides around you every second right now. Right now. He's in the room here listening to every word I say. Right? It's right here. Let that sink in first. It's right here. It takes 3 seconds sometimes. Close your mouth and think, well, Hashem's here. I'm not going to shoot off at the mouth in front of Him. I wouldn't do it in front of people sometimes who are officially important. So in front of Hashem. That's what's called the pasuk in Tehillim. It says, Al tevahil al picha. Don't rush your mouth. V'libcha al yimahil lehoitzi dover lefnei elekim. Your mind should not rush to push out words in front of Hashem. Ki elekim b'shamayim v'ata al ha'oretz. Hashem is in heaven and you're on earth. As in, He's very lofty and He's right there. Al ken yud v'recha ma'atim. Don't talk so much. Right? No. Again, you want to be regular, normal, natural people and healthy people, and we will speak, Be'ezer Hashem, to others, as long as we're not being hurtful, chas v'shalom, we should speak. But if occasionally, even once in a while, a person takes the opportunity for 2 minutes or less, 30 seconds, keep your mouth closed and think for a second. Hashem is right here, I can't do that. So it gives us a consciousness of the Rebbeinu, which we can then take with us into the Siddur. Okay, so this is the religious answer. Now I want to move on to the emotional answer. And, you know, everyone could ask themselves their own question about this if they want. But this is something that is a truth. It's a truism which applies to some people, maybe not to some others. It's definitely a fact that should be recognized as such and thought about. And that is this. A person only has one heart. It's either open or closed. And sometimes a person could have their heart closed, not in a religious sense necessarily, on an emotional, personal level. In other words, emotion doesn't run freely, right? Sometimes we can be intellectual creatures more than we necessarily want to be. And the heart doesn't play as much of a role. We find ourselves to be more closed than we would like to be, let's say. And sometimes such a person either doesn't realize that that's going on, or they do, but they don't necessarily make the connection between that and what's going on in their davening, in their religious experiences, or anything else, and start to blame themselves religiously somehow, as if I'm not righteous enough or frum enough, and that's why I don't feel my connection to Rebbeinu Shlom, I don't feel my connection to Yiddishkeit, I don't feel my connection to davening, and it's all because I'm not frum enough. And it often has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with one's own heart, as in it's closed to oneself, to everyone around. Emotion doesn't play enough of a role there, and it's not going to play a role in religion either, because you don't get to get one heart for Rebbeinu Shlom and a different heart for everybody else. And the same thing is true, by the way, for all feelings and midas. One of the best things we could do with our feelings and midas as we express them among our family, peers, friends, etc., is to use that as a practice, because these are tangible figures in our life, and it's easier to create that relationship with people we actually see, and then to use that to carry over into our relationship with the Rebbeinu Shlom, who's somebody we don't see. But what if we don't have necessarily such active emotional lives going on? So it's very hard for us to have an emotional religious life when we don't have an emotional life altogether. Before I went into Rabbanus here, did a lot of counseling and psychotherapy in Eretz Yisrael. And I remember a woman who once told me she was a Yesaima from a very young age. I'm not making any generalizations, so if anyone, whatever, it just happens to be that story. And she was a Yesaima from a very young age, maybe 10 or 12 years old, and basically what meant the most to her and her family was, we are fine. We are fine. We are just fine. Thank you. And please leave us alone. We don't need your help, we don't need your sympathy, we're just fine, we're okay, we have it all figured out, we're just fine. Like she said to me in Hebrew the first time that I ever met this woman, she said to me, all you say in Hebrew, I don't even know how to translate this in English, maybe you'll help me though. But she said, "Anachna ha'mashpacha chi zoremet bebnei brak." We are, how do you say that? I don't even know how to translate that. Chi zoremet. It means to flow. In other words, we have it made. We're fine. It's all done. It's fine. Don't worry. We're okay. Right? We're fine. And this is where she let nobody in. Huh? No, we're okay. Right? We're just fine. Thank you. And everything is fine. And leave us alone. Right? And so she let nobody in, including her own husband or anyone else. Nobody was allowed in. Closed. Like I sometimes say, there's a Kodesh HaKadosh in there that even the Kohen Gadol doesn't go into, not even once a year. Right? And nobody gets in there, including the person himself. Nobody ever gets in there. And this woman, after several sessions of therapy, she said to me, and she's the one, the first one who taught me that lesson that I just said. She said, I always beat myself up for having no feeling in my davening, no feeling in my Yiddishkeit. You can't imagine, she said, how I killed myself over that. And how many shmuzim I tried to listen to. They try to wake up that dead Jew that was inside, what's wrong with you? And only now am I understanding, she said, that this is not a religious issue. Not a religious issue. It's an emotional issue, because as I've begun to open up my feelings to myself and to others, suddenly I find my feelings in Yiddishkeit, I've begun to open up parallel to that. In other words, sometimes it has nothing to do with the whole big shmooze I just said before about relationship with Hashem and learning and thinking and whatever else it is. It's something that has to do with the person on a personal level, and the fact that if the heart is closed, it's closed, and if it's open, it's open. Now, if it's open, and still one finds that as open as it is, and as vulnerable as a person can be, and as real as a person can be, and as expressive as a person can be, still it doesn't go in davening, refer back to A, right? But otherwise, B is definitely food for thought.
I'm not understanding. What do you mean that she didn't feel for, she didn't open up her heart? I mean, she felt for her children, she felt for her husband. I'm sure she felt when other people were in pain and she wanted to help them. What does it mean the heart was not open?
So first of all, you're making an assumption which may or may not be true. As in, she felt for her husband or she didn't. She felt for her children or she didn't. There are many very devoted mothers who don't feel much at all, but they do their job well. Right? In other words, it's a job. Just like many of us are very driven in our jobs and we do them well. We can do motherhood or fatherhood for that matter very much in the same way. In terms of, an responsible person, a devoted person. This is what I'm meant to do. We can get very religious about that, by the way, also. It's the right thing to do. That doesn't mean that there's a natural sense of warmth or feeling there. May not be there. Right? So that's an assumption. Also, this is something that's a big tradition to a lot of people. Sometimes we can have feelings for other people, but not for ourselves. And this happens very often, much easier to have feelings for other people than for ourselves. Right? I'll feel bad for the other person, but not for myself. And when it's me, I'll say no, and I'll put on an artificial smile and keep walking, even though there isn't any smile on the inside, it's on the outside. And maybe everybody around enjoys that a lot, but the person himself is suffering, and it's no fun at all to never be able to just fall apart and just be real. But so that's what it actually means. So, like I said, that can be food for thought. Everybody has their own feeling about themselves, but it could be something to be thought about. I just wanted to bring that up as one possible explanation for what actually could be going on, even in the context of davening. It could be just a plain personal, emotional type of situation. Okay. Any other questions on the general subject, or I'll move on to the next point in the Chayes Halvadas?
I would assume that heart.
That's an interesting question, and most people think that that's a ridiculous proposition. But you're talking to one person who doesn't. So, and not just any therapy, only specific ones. But in any case, depends. No, that's fine. Probably if you were, you wouldn't have said it. But in any case, well, at least not in public.
Like, following up what we said, if somebody thinks their heart is closed, then what do they do?
So I'll say one thing that I generally believe. And again, here I'm speaking more as a therapist than a Rav, but it goes hand in hand anyway. Lamaisa, the truth of the matter is, awareness is very liberating. Awareness is liberating, awareness is empowering. These are the words that I've said many dozens of times. And they're very true, and I've seen it in action. I've been fortunate to see it in action so often in the last 13 years. And it's very powerful. Therefore, sometimes a person becomes aware of where they're at, and that itself starts to push them in the right direction, and then maybe they don't have to go for therapy. But if somebody feels that it's getting in their way and it's not changing, I don't think therapy is a dirty word. I've never thought so. I think it's a tremendously powerful thing. Those who do it right could be life-altering, mamish, on every single level. Every single level. Mamish. It could be a different quality of life altogether. So, the next thing in the Chayes Halvadas, after Hisyachadus HaNefesh and Hashem, is Kini Oso Loi. Kini Oso Loi. That means, that refers to humility towards Hashem. humility towards Hashem. When we discuss that, what is the humility towards Hashem? So we know, Ekev Anova, Yiras Hashem. The lowest part of Anova, the heel, literally the heel of Anova, the heel of humility, is Yiras Hashem. What does that mean? Yiras Hashem. Ekev Anova, Yiras Hashem. What does that mean? Yiras Hashem. Yiro and Re'io are the same letters transposed, same exact letters. It's Reish Aleph Yud Hey, Yud Reish Aleph Hey, it's the same words. Yiro, when it refers to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that's the true awe, we'll translate it as awe right now, means to perceive Hashem, to be aware, but real awareness. And this takes us a little bit back to what we were just discussing. Right? A real and true awareness and perception of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's called Yiras Hashem in a real sense. In other words, fear, and not because I'm allergic to the word fear, Yiras Hashem also means fear of Hashem. However, really translating it in the right way would be referring to true and sensory awareness and perception of Hashem. And when one has that Yiras Hashem, in terms of feeling Hashem and therefore being in awe of Him, it brings in its wake humility. In other words, to truly feel and perceive Hashem brings humility in its wake. And therefore, when we find Ekev Anova, Yiras Hashem, it means if we want to get to true humility, that has to come from awareness of Hashem. And this, as somebody asked me last week after the last week's share, somebody asked me, what about the next thing that it says? Isn't that the same thing? Can he also loy im harayim usleboira? Im harayim usleboira, while exalting our Creator? And the answer is yes and no. That's always the easiest answer, by the way. Yes and no. In other words, it's really two things, but it's two sides of one coin. It's much easier to feel humbled when you are able to exalt Hashem. In other words, when you see how high, powerful, mighty Hashem is, of course, your own humility will be all the greater. And vice versa. The more humble you are, the easier it is to get the perception of how great Hashem is. So, of course, these two things will feed off of each other. But when we speak of Roimim Muslabaira, exalting Hashem, it refers in particular to the same three things which we'll constantly discuss, which is Hashem's wisdom, how wise He is, how much wisdom there is in creation, how much wisdom there is in the way Hashem also runs the world, daily, weekly, monthly, and annually. And Gevura, power, Hashem's power, strength, might, and chesed, mainly chesed. Because, as we know, Hashem, you're so mighty. Rav lo hishia, you're great to help. Right? In other words, Hashem's greatness is there in order to help human beings. That's what this world is here for. Chofetz chesed hu. He desires kindness. And, as it says in Tehillim, ki amarti, because I say... What does that mean, I say? I say means this is a big statement of mine, which is coming out of after a lot of thought. Yamardi, I say, Olam Chesed Yibana. The world is built for kindliness. And therefore, everything that we see or speak about, when we speak about Hashem, has to at the end end up with realizing Hashem's kindness. That is sometimes easier than other times. Sometimes more difficult to realize that, clearly. But when we speak about exalting Hashem, this is what we're talking about. So again, let's do a recap of those three things. We have Hesiachtes HaNefesh in Boiro. It's the yearning of the soul to unite with Hashem, right? To commune with Hashem, to feel as one with Hashem, to feel close with Hashem. We have humility in front before Hashem, which, like we said, humility comes along with an awareness, with a perception that is real, And then the other side of that coin, exalting Hashem for his wisdom, for his might, and most of all, exalting Hashem for his kindness. So that'll be enough for tonight. Generally, again, I welcome questions on the subject. Off to